I thought that I would share something of my journey to the present. I always say when I introduce myself that I was lucky. I was lucky to have been born and brought up in Montego Bay, Jamaica. And I say that because there I could see images of myself in all walks of life. So I grew up knowing that I could become whatever I wanted to be, and there ought not to be any obstacles. At a very early age, I was baptized at 4 months into the Anglican Church in Jamaica, which at the time, I think at the time, it was still the Church of England in Jamaica, until we had a bishop who said, this is nonsense. It ought to be the Diocese of Jamaica, the Church of Jamaica. And so we're still Anglican, but not the Church of England in Jamaica. And so went to school. I refer to myself actually as a cradle Anglican because of being brought into the church at such an early age. And then Sunday school, all of that. Parents, we have a system in the Caribbean, certainly in Jamaica. I'm not quite sure how it works in some of the other Caribbean islands. But our main services in the main parish church starts at 7:30 a.m. And if it's Christmas and Easter, then you're looking at 5:30 or sometimes 6 o'clock. And I can tell you, for Easter and Christmas, there are no spare seats. So you've got to get there early. And also, I will tell you that if you have visitors with you, then you bring them along. I remember how shocked I was when I worked in Hackney, and a wonderful lady who was always at church. And this particular Easter Sunday, she wasn't there. And I immediately thought she must be unwell. And so straight after church, communion box, I've got to go to her, and I've got to make sure she has her Easter communion. And I got there, and to my horror, she was perfectly fine. Perfectly fine. But guess what? Her son had come to visit. Really? Now, back in my time growing up in the Caribbean, if whether your son or whoever it is come to visit, if they don't want to come with you, they can stay at home and look after themselves. You know? And I just think that sometimes we need to think about the messages that we give to family members about what this thing called faith is to us. What does it mean? How important is it that we just says, oh, you know, I don't have to go because, you know, why don't we invite them? Even if we know that they are sort of, not so sure about church, why don't we still say to them, it's Easter. It's a very important time in the life of the church. Would you like to come? And if they say, absolutely not, then we say, okay, you know where the kettle is, you know where that is, I'm going. Because they then learn that it is important to you. It's the same way, too, when our children or our grandchildren say to us, I don't want to go to church. And we just say, all right, then. And yet, when they wake up and they say, I don't want to go to school, we don't have a big argument with them about how important school is. We check their temperature, and if there is, from our perspective, they haven't got a broken limb and there's nothing wrong with them, you just say, you're going to school. So the child learns from this that this is important. So when we just say, all right, then you don't have to, then the child is learning from us, the adults, that this is not really that important. So when my daughter came home from university and said to me, we're having our dinner, and she said, Mummy, what if I don't believe anymore? And I pretended I didn't hear her and continued eating. So she thought I hadn't heard and repeated the question. I placed my utensils down and I said, Darling, I don't care whether you believe or not, but while you live in this house and eat the food that God has provided, take part, breathe the air in this house that God gives us, we are a Christian family. We will worship. They're in their 30s now, and they worship. So I just think that we need to be careful about the messages that we give to our children and our grandchildren as well about what this thing called faith is and what it means to us, the importance of it in our lives. So going back to my childhood, Sunday school, and so you have your main parish church, 7:30 early service, and then the priest would then go to two other services that morning. So he would do, and it was usually a he then, he would do a 7:30, a 9:30, and an 11 o'clock. And then if he wasn't lucky, he would also have a 6:30 in the evening. But so where I lived was right opposite the 9:30 church. The adults got up and they went to the early service in the town. And as children, we were then sent along just across the road to go to the 9:30 service, which is mostly morning prayer because the priest had to alternate. There were two services that were at 9:30 and two at 11. So this week he would do this set, next week he would do the 7:30 plus another 9:30, another 11 o'clock. And that was terrific. That was terrific because not having a priest every week meant that as young people, we were able to actively get involved. We had a wise reader. We don't say lay reader anymore, we say reader. We had a wise reader who didn't hog the show for himself, and he gave us a Sunday. He gave us a Sunday when the priest wasn't there. And that was our Sunday. So we did the readings, we led, we interceded, we did the chorus, the singing. Amazing! And for me, I think I always say that that's where I cut my teeth for ministry, from those days in my little church, St. Francis Mission in Glendevon. And then when I was 14 years old, I had this overwhelming sense of being called to ministry. And it's interesting being called to something that does not exist. But I remember having a conversation with God, which went something like, God, I believe that you have called me to this. So I will be faithful to that call, and I will leave you to work out the rest. So at a very early age, I had a sense that women could be priests. And not only that they could be, but that they should be. And I remember asking the bishop at the time, why is it that there were churches who had no priest? Because we were very short of priests, mostly, and we still are in Jamaica. And you have taught us that the sacrament is important, and yet there are churches that would go for 9 months, 6 to 9 months, without a priest. And his response was, well, you know, we're Anglicans and that's the way it is. Not something that sat comfortably with me. It cannot be the way that it is when we are told that we are the body of Christ and that we all have a responsibility, all baptized have a responsibility to proclaim and live the gospel of Jesus Christ. So when I finished high school, I worked for a year, and during that year, I applied for the Church Army. Have you heard of the Church Army? The Church Army, we had Church Army in Jamaica, and I was aware that we had Church Army officers who were women. So that was one way into ministry. And I came to the United Kingdom, trained. Blackheath was where the college was at the time, and trained for 3 years, and then I went back. My husband, who is a Geordie, just happened to have been a year ahead of me in the Church Army College. He says he remembers the first day I arrived that he helped to take my luggage from the van into the college. I have no recollection of him then. Wasn't on my mind, not a priority. So he later joined me in Jamaica, and we got married, worked there for a while, and then we came back to the UK. And then when I came back to the UK, they were beginning to ordain women as deacons. So I offered myself for ordination as a deacon, and there was no sense of, you know, we need more diverse leadership within the church, so let's test this vocation. Instead, the response that I had back was, you're married, you have a child, you ought to be at home looking after your husband and your child. My response was, my husband was perfectly capable of looking after himself. And if I hadn't thought about how I would manage my child, then I would not have, you know, put myself forward. So nothing happened for a while, and then by the time, it must have been almost 2 years before anything started, I think the bishop, you know, pushed at it again. And by now I was pregnant with number two, and I decided I'm not going to tell them. Because if they reacted like that to one child, what might they do about two? But of course, it's not something you can hide. And so by the time they called me in for the next interview, I was 2 weeks away from delivering. And so I walked in, and this time, interestingly, it was a male examining chaplain that I had. And as he opened the door, I said, I hope your midwifery skills are intact, because I gather you can deliver either side of your 2 week dates. But he was brilliant. He never once asked me how I was going to cope with motherhood or anything like that. We did theology, we talked theology, and etc. And then we moved diocese, because my husband was now ordained, so we moved diocese, went up to Lichfield, so the whole process started all over again, and this time it went through. So I was ordained a deacon in 1991, and then the church that I was sent to, invited to, was a church that did not believe that women should be in charge. So it's the headship thing. Now, I knew that they had those views, but I felt that that was where God was calling me to be, and so I went. The PCC resigned because they were not very happy. And what was interesting for me is that for the whole time that I spent with them, I never once got involved with dialogue about the rightness of women to be ordained. Because, you know, I feel very strongly about it. I will say what I need to say. But when it comes to ministry, I think we ought to get on with it. We get on with it in whatever capacity we are able to. And that is important. I can tell you that one thing I did which was rather foolish. But having said that, with my hand on my heart, I don't know whether I wouldn't do it again. And I'll tell you what I did. I had to have knee surgery. And it was a day surgery, but, you know, you're back home and you're meant then to rest. So I couldn't drive, but I got my husband the very next day to drive me over to the parish. And I hobbled around with walking sticks. Because I heard myself saying, I don't want this congregation to say, see, she's a woman, she's black, she can't hack it. And I find it very sad that I cannot convince myself that I still wouldn't do that today, well over 20 years later. But I had an amazing time in the parish. I loved it. The vicar became ill shortly after I got there. He had back surgery, so he was off. And so I was in charge of the church. But it was great. Got on with ministry. Got them to change the times of their service. And you know how precious we get about things like that. But proper consultation, working with them, and they still have that time that we changed it today. And it was a really foundational time for ministry there. The church grew. The whole thing was pretty amazing. 2 weeks before I was ordained as a priest, I had one woman say to me, I want you to know that I was one of those who resigned from the PCC, but I now believe that God calls women. And I can tell you that there is not one person left in that church who does not believe that women should be fully integrated in leadership within the life of the church. And it wasn't because of preaching to them and telling them that they should believe this or believe that. It was simply journeying alongside them, walking with them, and getting on with that which one is called to do. So from there, I also had a diocesan role in Lichfield Diocese. And then I moved to West Bromwich because my husband got a church in West Bromwich that he was now in charge of. Also, I had a neighboring church. And then he was ready to go into prison ministry. He's always wanted to go into prison ministry. When he left Church Army, while he was at Church Army, he had done a prison placement at Strangeways in Manchester and was quite moved by that and have always said he wanted to do prison ministry. So he was looking and hoping to go into that. And I just happened to have been visiting the bishop in London, and the bishop said, I've got two churches that needs a vicar and an associate. Now, my husband and I, we've never worked together. We help each other out, but I think, and there are great clergy couples who work together perfectly. But I think for us, I'm not sure, you know, if we would know when we were talking to each other as the vicar or the, do you know what I mean? Or the assistant or the, I don't know. It's a different dynamics. And I think every clergy couple have got to know. I've seen couples that are brilliant doing it together. I don't think we would be brilliant doing it together. But we help each other out. We've always helped each other out. So although we didn't think this was necessarily the right step forward, we thought, let's go and have a look at it for him. He's the one looking for a post. I was already in a post. And so we came down to London, and we were in Hackney. We went to see the church in Hackney. There were two churches. And the area, I mean, it's all upmarket now, but it was very dilapidated at the time. One of the churches was overgrown, the windows smashed. Inside on the upstairs had black sacks all around, and they were known as the Jumbo Sale Church. So every weekend when the jumbo sales were finished, they would just sort of bag up the rest of the stuff and hoist it up onto the balcony. And it was a real mess. It really was. But, you know, I fell in love with it. I fell in love with it. And on the way going back, my husband said to me, Rose, I don't think I could do this. And I looked across at him and I said, darling, if they would have me, I would love the challenge. So I got back home and I wrote to the bishop. And I said to the bishop, my husband does not think that this is right for him, but if you would have me, I would love the challenge. Bishop said yes. And we had both sort of been interviewed, as it were. But then there were rumblings. There were rumblings. Again, folks didn't want to have me. And although I knew that, I decided that I was still going to, you know, I felt, you know, I'm a gut person. When something feels right, then I know that that is the Spirit saying yes. So for me, the Spirit had said yes. And then I was told, well, they want to re-interview you again. And I thought, no. You know, they've interviewed me already. I know what was going on in there, you know, in the background. You're interviewing me now as the Crown's nomination person, and you can decide, you know. If you decide that you're happy for me to go, then I'm happy to go. But I don't want to go back to them and to be re-interviewed by them. And so they said yes, and I went. And this small group of folks were very unhappy at my very first meeting with the wardens, four wardens. One of them said to me, the only reason why there were so many people at your first service is because we were expecting a male priest. And we were rather put out seeing you there. And I was sort of gulped. You know, it's quite a shock to hear that. And so I then said, while you are laying your cards on the table, would you like to put all your cards on the table? Has it got anything to do with the fact that I'm black? Because I'd heard rumblings. And the response was, well, frankly, yes. So my reaction to them was, now that you've put your cards on the table, let me put mine on the table. I have just arrived here. I have no intention of going. So if you're not happy with me, then you're free to go. They didn't leave immediately. And they made life difficult. I used to walk around the parish singing, Jesus be a fence. Jesus be a fence all around me every day. Jesus, I want you to protect me as I travel along life's way. Lord, I know you can. Lord, I know you will. Fight the battle if I keep still. Be a fence all around me every day. I used to sing. That was my mantra. That was my prayer. So they didn't leave immediately, but they eventually left. And I can tell you that the church grew. The church grew. I spent 16 and a half years in Hackney, and I describe it as the best years of my life. The best years. It was amazing, challenging, amazing, gritty, wonderful, really was. And then there was a huge building works that was needed as well in one of the churches. Got that done, and then it was time to move on. And I was in Jamaica when my husband said that there's a job going at the Abbey. And my response was, I don't know. I want real work, I said. My idea of real work is not walking around wearing red robes. I knew nothing. I assumed it's very similar to a cathedral type, you know, role. But I felt that I needed, coming from Hackney, I wanted something as gritty, you know, something that every day, at the end of the day, you feel that you have made a difference, that something has happened, you've touched a life, do you get where I'm coming from? And so I thought nothing else of it again, until two priests in the deanery, totally independent of each other, and two priests who were people of prayer. And you might think that's an odd thing to say. Not all priests meet prayers, but these two priests, they were Peter and Paul, even though one was male and one was female. And they said to me, Rose, have you seen the job going at the Abbey? We think that you should apply for it. And I'm thinking, how odd that they would try and direct me to a role like that. So I thought, maybe God is speaking to me about it. So I then called it up, looked at it, and got very excited. In particular, at the section that said chaplain to the Speaker of the House of Commons. I did not know who the Speaker was, but the one thing I knew was that I felt passionately about faith being in the public square. I believe that faith is not a garment we put on and off depending on the weather. Faith is who we are. So I'm not talking about proselytizing. I'm talking about encouraging those of faith to live out what it means to be the people of God in that public sphere where you are placed. So I was very excited about it and thought, yes, I'll go for it. I'm told that 97 people applied, 6 of us were shortlisted, and we had our interviews. And what was interesting, it took us 2 weeks before the results of the interviews came out, what I did not know then was that there was wranglings going on. Parliament said yes to me. The Abbey said no to me. The Abbey thought that I wasn't right for them. Parliament thought that I was right. Or should I say, Mr. Speaker thought that I was right. The press got involved and they had a field day. I think it was in the Daily Mail where they had two columns. One column for my colleague who got the other half. They actually split the post because they could not agree. The headline for my other colleague who got the post at the Abbey, the other half, was "The Oxford Graduate." The headline for my column was "The Girl from Montego Bay." A few years ago, I met the author of that piece, and I said to him, "What you don't know is that you have given me the title for my autobiography. So when I write it, it will be The Girl from Montego Bay." It's very interesting. I have members who have come up to me. I've been there now over 8 years. Members who come up to me and they'll say, "I was one of those who thought, you know, Mr. Burko is just being PC, why he's having you. But, you know, thank you. You have made a huge difference. I got that wrong." Is it important to me that they say that? Not necessarily. But it is important for them that they see that a chaplain who is not an establishment figure, in inverted commas, can successfully do the role in Parliament. I think I would also share with you something else, because these are sort of important timelines. In my, the role in Parliament was very much part-time, a few hours, and so I needed to find another part-time role to go with it that would give me accommodation as well. And in my search for that, I was shortlisted and not, well, but prior to Parliament, actually, I was shortlisted, sitting in the waiting room, just my husband and I sitting in the waiting room. It was clear that it was a woman. My name is Rose. Not very many men I've met called Rose. And the chair of the panel comes in, and he says, "I've come to get the next person for their interview, but I can see that they're not here." And walks back out again. And so from that moment on, I felt this is not the environment that I want to be in. And then I was shortlisted. Sorry, I wasn't shortlisted for other things. And so I asked, it just so happened to have been the same chair. And I asked, you know, "When you did not know who I was, you shortlisted me. Now that you know who I am, I don't get shortlisted. I'm not going to be applying for anything else because that's going to waste my time." So there are challenges along the way. People will say to me, "What is it that makes you keep going?" And my response has always been, for you to keep going, you need to know who called you and what you're called to, and then remain focused on that. That really is important. Because otherwise, you can be knocked around to the extent that you give up. And giving up has never been an option for me.